We are in Deuteronomy 31 today. We're going to cover Deuteronomy 31 and 32 as we're coming closely, rapidly, I guess, to the close of our class here on Deuteronomy. In fact, last time we wrapped up Moses' third sermon, which is a bit shorter. I tend to look at 31 and following as more of a postscript than a continuance of that last sermon. That really is, again, the bulk of Deuteronomy are these three sermons that Moses is speaking to the people. And then from here on out is this postscript kind of information. That kind of, again, tells you how quickly we're coming to the end of things. In fact, you might remember this structure we saw way back at the beginning. You probably don't remember the structure we saw way back at the beginning. But this is kind of how the book of Deuteronomy is put together in addition to the kind of linear sequence of the sermons themselves. But the beginning and end is introduction and conclusion, although the first the beginning is also that part of that first sermon. But then it comes to the focus of the book of Deuteronomy being the covenant itself. You get the basis of the covenant in chapters 4 through 11, some of the principles that everything is built on, then the detailed stipulations of the covenant there at the heart of the book, in the middle, then the covenant ceremony, what that's going to look like. We've talked about the last couple of weeks. And now we move to what is we're calling here on this slide, at least the outer frame, that the book is closing with a look forward into the future rather than a look backward into the past that it began with. And in fact, that we've seen so much. And that's been one of our running points is how rooted in history the covenant itself is, and tells you how important that history is, that it's not, you know, some made-up mythology sort of thing, but this is real life, God interacting in space and time with people that this relationship is built out of. And so these chapters, chapter 30, which is the prelude to the Song of Moses, chapter 31, which is the Song of Moses, as it's called, at least, are about what's going to happen in the future, immediate future and distant future, both is what we'll see working our way through this. And it begins with a discussion of the transfer of leadership from Moses to Joshua. And there's some interesting things going on here in this text. Actually, let's go ahead and read it first, and then we'll talk about some of the things going on here. Deuteronomy chapter 31, verse 1. So Moses continued to speak these words to all Israel, and he said to them, "I'm 120 years old today. I'm no longer able to go out and to come in. The Lord has said to me, 'You shall not go over this Jordan. The Lord, your God himself will go over before you. He will destroy these nations before you so that you shall dispossess them, and Joshua will go over as your head, as the Lord has spoken. And the Lord will do to them as he did to Sihon and Og, the kings of the Amorites, and to their land when he destroyed them. And the Lord will give them over to you, and you shall do to them according to the whole commandment that I've commanded you. Be strong and courageous. Do not fear or be in dread of them, for it is the Lord your God who goes with you. He will not leave you or forsake you.' Then Moses summoned Joshua and said to him, 'In the sight of all Israel, be strong and courageous, for you shall go with this people into the land that the Lord has sworn to their fathers to give them, and you shall put them in possession of it. It is the Lord who goes before you. He will be with you. He will not leave you or forsake you. Do not fear or be dismayed.'" Well, first of all, I think it's worth noting that the transfer of leadership is a pretty common biblical topic when you stop and you think about it. I mean, it's common just in general that it happens, but beyond it just happening, the discussion of transfer of leadership happens pretty frequently in the Bible. You see it here, of course. You see it from Samuel to Saul being a key point in some of the narrative there. You see it from David to Solomon. You see it from Elijah to Elisha. You see it from Jesus to the 12. You see it from Paul to Timothy. And probably a few other places that I didn't mention. But this idea of one leader going out and another leader coming in, and the things that are involved in that is a significant enough biblical topic that probably we need to spend a little bit more time just thinking about that by itself and studying those kinds of texts. That's not what we're doing today, but at least to just kind of put that in your mind, that leaders are an important part of God's people. And as one goes out and another comes in, that is a significant moment for a variety of reasons, and we probably should give some thought to that. Now, as to this text itself, there are two points of focus, which, as we think about this perhaps more for future kinds of studies and for practical moments, these two points would certainly go into that. First of all is the point that is, I think, clear all the way through this. Your real leader hasn't changed. Moses is going the way of the world, but your leader hasn't changed. Moses won't go before you. Moses says, you know, I can't go out and I can't go in. God says, I can't go over the Jordan, but the Lord, your God himself, will go on before you. And then when he's talking to Joshua in the sight of all the people in verse 8, it is the Lord who goes before you. The fundamental point is that their real leader hasn't changed at all. And so there really should never be a time that they can't be strong and courageous, that they can't face the future with courage, because God has promised that he's always going to be their leader. And so the first word that Moses says isn't, well, I'm going to die, so I guess we need a new leader. No, I'm going to die, but that's all right because your leader hasn't changed. Your leader is the same who has always led you, and he will continue to lead you. And in fact, if God wasn't leading us, it really wouldn't matter who our leader was. And he doesn't come out and say that, but that's the bottom line. Without divine leadership, human leadership's irrelevant. It doesn't have any point whatsoever. There's no significance to it. And so this is the fundamental point. But beyond that, I think it's also important that God realizes they need human leadership too. They need someone on the ground with them. That is kind of part of human nature, and that has always been the case. You know, we give them a hard time when they ask for a king. You know, give us a king like the nations. Oh, look how faithless they were. Well, they had Moses before that, and they had Joshua, and they had all the judges, and no one ever lampoons them for having other human leaders. You put a crown on his head, and suddenly they're faithless. Well, no, people need leadership. That's why, you know, God has given the church elders. He has given leadership even to us to this day. And so divine leadership is incarnational, I guess you might say. It's found in human leaders. God will lead them, but God will also lead them by means of someone that he puts in that task. And in this case, of course, it's Joshua. And then Joshua is summoned, and Joshua is set before all of the people, and Joshua is encouraged in the sight of all the people that God's presence is with him to empower him and to carry out his task and to do all the things he needs to do. And all of those are the exact same promises that God gave to Moses. And so the degree to which God is with Joshua will at least be, you know, in terms of the promise, the same as it was to Moses before him. The nature of their relationship will be different. That's, again, kind of a key point, that no one has had the same kind of relationship with God that Moses did. But be that as it may, you know, this is, I think, pretty important as we think about leadership. You know, you find yourself in a leadership role in the church at some point in your life, perhaps. Understand your leadership is rooted in God's promises, not your ability. I mean, that's kind of there at the end of verse 7. Be strong and courageous, for you shall go with this people into the land that the Lord has sworn to their fathers to give them, and you shall put them in possession of it. Is it because of Joshua's leadership ability, or because God has made promises that God is going to keep, that he's going to be successful? Well, it's because of God. That's why it's going to work out. And Joshua's ability is rooted in what God has given him, of course. But then also, verse 8, you can count on the unfailing presence of God when you lead his people. It is the Lord who goes before you. He will be with you. He will never leave you or forsake you. Don't fear or be dismayed. And then the last thing that I'd say about this as we think about leadership is that in the Bible, leaders are never put in a position, maybe I should say it that way, they're never put into a position of leadership. They're given a task of leadership. And what I mean when I say that is there aren't leaders for the sake of being leaders. They aren't leaders for the sake of having the status of being a leader. They are leaders for the sake of doing a job. Every biblical leader you ever find, at least as God envisions it and as God describes it, they are leaders with a task, not leaders with a status. And there is a status that comes with it, but that's not the point of the leadership. It's the work that is the constant in all of these texts. All right. Questions, comments, accusations? Yeah.
Accusation.
Perfect.
Is this a retelling of Numbers 27, or do you think this is a separate retelling of the event?
I honestly didn't look closely enough at Numbers 27 as I was getting ready for this to have a even remotely educated answer to that question.
I'm not even looking at it now.
I mean, it conceivably, I think it could be either one. There are these kinds of retellings that you find from one book to the next. Or it could be a separate, you know, commissioning and reinforcement in the context of this covenant sermon and all of those kinds of things. But I don't know offhand. It's a really good question. Why don't you look into that and let us know next week? Anything else? All right. Well, moving on then, we get to a discussion of the reading of the law in verses 9 through 13. Moses wrote this law and gave it to the priests, the sons of Levi, who carried the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, and to all the elders of Israel. And Moses commanded them at the end of every 7 years, at the set time in the year of release, at the Feast of Booths, when Israel comes to appear before the Lord your God at the place that he will choose, you shall read this law before all Israel in their hearing. Assemble the people, men, women, and little ones, and the sojourner within your towns, that they may hear and learn to fear the Lord your God, and be careful to do all the words of this law, and that their children who have not known it may hear and learn to fear the Lord your God, as long as you live in the land that you are going over the Jordan to possess. And so this in itself is an ongoing necessity, and it's because every generation there are going to come people who don't know. It's the responsibility of the parents to train their children to know the Lord. And this generation, they've experienced things in the wilderness that, and they're going to experience things in Canaan that are going to mark on them in a way that just can't be duplicated, the faithfulness of God. But the next generation won't have that, and the generation after that won't have that. And so what needs to be done is an ongoing sharing together in the covenant itself, in the law. We saw at the end of, or kind of in the middle, I guess, of chapter 30 last week, the commandment that I command you is not too hard for you, neither is it too far off. It's not in heaven that you should say, who will ascend to heaven and bring it down, that we may hear it. Neither is it beyond the sea that you would say, who will go over the sea and bring it to us. But the word is very near to you. It is in your mouth and in your heart so that you can do it. It is accessible. It is intelligible. And that is all pointless if they're not actually reading it. It doesn't matter how easy it is to understand God's revelation. If we close it up and stick it in a drawer and never look at it, its intelligibility is worthless to us. And so the people need to constantly be hearing this. Now, again, the broader cultural context of Deuteronomy, we've talked about how Deuteronomy follows the basic pattern of an ancient Near Eastern covenant treaty. All the various elements of ancient Near Eastern covenant treaties show up in Deuteronomy. Well, part of that as well is arrangement for the storage of the covenant and a periodic reading of the covenant. So aside from the practical religious necessity of reading this that we were just talking about, it also fits what Deuteronomy is doing in terms of the covenant document that details the relationship between God and His people. That there needs to be this periodic reading. There needs to be arrangement for storage, and that even shows up here as well. And then also that it is who's going to be in charge of this. Notice it is to the priests, the sons of Levi, and the elders of the people, which is to say it's both the religious and the civil leaders, because the law embraces all of life. It's not the religious law and civil's its own thing. It's not the civil law and religion's its own thing. This distinction between religious life and secular life that you hear about so much in our culture is a purely modern invention that doesn't show up anywhere in the Bible whatsoever. In the Bible, all life is God's life. Everything you do belongs to Him, and there is no such thing as secular life apart from God, regardless of what your profession is, regardless of what your hobbies are. It is all under the umbrella of what you do as a Christian. And that is, that's reflected here. That's not the main point here, but I think it's an important point to keep in mind as well. And then the last thing that I'd say about this is when it is to happen is in the Sabbath year, at the Feast of Booths, or the Feast of Tabernacles, as it's called as well. That's the one where they, you know, have their tents and they remember the wilderness wandering and so forth. And what that means is they are reading the law in the context of historical redemption in the Feast of Booths, what God had done for them. And they're remembering it in the context of grace, that is to say the Sabbath year, when things are set free and God is keeping His promises. And so for the law to be read in the context of redemption and grace tells us something about this law. It's something that we've been saying through Deuteronomy all along, really, is that it's not just, you know, we talk about the Old Covenant sometimes as just checklist religion because it's just these rules. That's not what the Old Testament ever was. It's not what the Old Covenant ever was. That's not what God has ever wanted. And you see that clearly in the prophets, but you also see it here. The law has to be read every 7 years. Yeah, it has to be read every 7 years at a point where they're focused wholly on redemption and grace. That by itself tells you how you are to be reading this law if you are among the people of Israel. All right, thoughts about verses 9 through 13 here. Yeah.
They would always have access to the
words themselves. Right. Yeah, and so, there is teaching of the law that is done. The priests and the Levites in particular, part of their role is to, you know, make sure that people know the law. This is more of a public communal, I'm probably kind of a, you know, reignite the fires of the covenant sort of thing beyond the ongoing teaching. Yeah, that's a good thought. That it's not like, all right, we're done with it for 7 years. Let's lock it up in here and not look at it again. That's not what would have been going on. I mean, probably that was what was going on, and they weren't even reading it every 7 years through at least part of their history. But, you know, not what was supposed to be going on.
It wasn't church every 7 years.
Right, yeah. Well, yeah, they didn't go to church once every 7 years, whether they needed to or not. All right, well, again, we come back to the commissioning of Joshua here in verses 14 through 29. And this is a section of text that it almost looks like a hodgepodge of information. It just seems to be bouncing around from one thing to another and then coming back. And it's interesting, you know, you read some of these commentaries that take this very liberal sort of critical view, and they're like, well, you know, Deuteronomy doesn't have anything to do with Moses anyway. It was written hundreds of years later, blah, blah, blah. And so this is just one of those spots that shows you all these different traditions that just kind of got mishmashed together. And that by itself, I think, is the greatest argument that perspective can't be true. Because nobody could write all of this that is this hodgepodge of information and not realize how bad of an editing job that they've done. I mean, I think I've got some freshmen that could do a better job than that in terms of putting something together in a coherent way. Maybe not all of them, but some of them at least who could do that. It's ridiculous some of the things they come up with. In fact, what's going on here seems to be another one of these parallel sorts of sections of the text where it is working its way to a central point and then building back out. And so in verses 9 through 13, you've got this focus on writing of the law, entrusting it to the Levites, assembling the people for a reading, which is then mirrored in verses 24 through 29. Again, focus on the writing of the law, entrusting it to the Levites, assembling the elders, in this case, to hear it. Two sections on the commissioning of Joshua, the second one just being a single verse. And then at the heart of it is the reason why the Song of Moses needs to be sung. Which is, again, when you've got this kind of structure, the center point is the point of emphasis, almost always, if not always. And so that becomes the center of this, is the need for the Song of Moses. But beyond that, it also joins the Song of Moses to everything else we've been talking about, having to do with the commissioning of Joshua, which again goes back to the beginning of chapter 31. And the Song of Moses itself then is going to become a song of remembrance in relation to the covenant. And what the covenant is doing is, it is, you know, you're writing this law and you're assembling it, the people for reading it or to hear the testimony. It is so you don't sin, and so that when you do sin, you know what you've done wrong, and you know why you're being punished. And the Song of Moses is going to have that same kind of significance as well. But also notice that although the center of this is this gloomy prediction of the people's unfaithfulness, as we'll see in a second when we read through this, there is still around it the promise that the people are going to receive the land. You're going to be faithless is kind of where this is working its way to. But in spite of the fact that you're going to be faithless, I'm still putting Joshua in charge and you're still going to take the land. God knows that they're going to fail, but he's going to fulfill his promises anyway. And that becomes in itself something of the basis of the theology of the prophets, you might say. The prophet's message, I mean, it can be summarized in a variety of ways, and I know I've summarized it in a variety of ways before, but part of it is, you know, the disaster that is coming upon you is because of your unfaithfulness. Because you've sinned in these different ways, because you've broken the covenant in these different ways, this disaster that is coming is because of your unfaithfulness. Yet in spite of that, there is hope for the future because God has promises that he hasn't fulfilled yet. And he is going to keep his promises, regardless of what you have or have not done in your life to this point. And there is no illusions at all about their unfaithfulness. Look ahead before we read this, just at verse 21, very quickly. When many evils and troubles have come upon them, this song shall confront them as a witness. For it will live unforgotten in the mouths of their offspring. For I know that they are inclined to do... what they are inclined to do even today before I've brought them into the land that I swore to give them. You catch that last part. God says, I know what they're inclined to do before they do it. Before I've given them this land, I know what they're inclined to do. And then you drop down to verse 27, and now Moses is speaking. He says, actually, verse 26, take this book of the law and put it by the side of the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God, that it may be there for witness against you. For I know how rebellious and stubborn you are. Behold, even today, while I am yet alive with you, you've been rebellious against the Lord. How much more after my death? There's no illusions at all about these people and what they're going to do. Yet in spite of that, God's promises remain. And God is going to keep his promises. Let's read through this very quickly, and then if you have comments about it before we then move on to the Song of Moses itself. Beginning in verse 14, and the Lord said to Moses, behold, the days approach when you must die. Call Joshua and present yourselves in the tent of meeting, that I may commission him. And Moses and Joshua went and presented themselves in the tent of meeting. And the Lord appeared in the tent in the pillar of a cloud, and the pillar of a cloud stood over the entrance of the tent. And the Lord said to Moses, behold, you are about to lie down with your fathers. Then this people will rise and whore after the foreign gods among them in the land that they are entering. And they will forsake me and break my covenant that I have made with them. Then my anger will be kindled against them in that day, and I will forsake them and hide my face from them, and they will be devoured, and many evils and troubles will come upon them, so that they will say in that day, have not these evils come upon us because our God is not among us? And I will surely hide my face in that day because of all the evil that they've done, because they have turned to other gods. Now, therefore, write this song and teach it to the people of Israel. Put it in their mouths, that this song may be witness for me against the people of Israel. For when I have brought them into the land flowing with milk and honey, which I swore to give to their fathers, and they have eaten and are full and grown fat, they will turn to other gods and serve them and despise me and break my commandment. And when many evils and troubles have come upon them, this song shall confront them as a witness, for it will live unforgotten in the mouths of their offspring. For I know that they are inclined to do evil even today, before I have brought them into the land that I swore to give. So Moses wrote this song the same day and taught it to the people of Israel. And the Lord commissioned Joshua, the son of Nun, and said, be strong and courageous, for you shall bring the people of Israel into the land that I swore to give to them. I will be with you. When Moses had finished writing the words of this law in a book to the very end, Moses commanded the Levites who carried the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, take this book of the law and put it by the side of the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God, that it may be there as a witness against you. For I know how rebellious and stubborn you are. Behold, even today, while I am yet alive with you, you've been rebellious against the Lord. How much more after my death? Assemble to me all the elders of your tribes and your officers, that I may speak these words in their ears and call heaven and earth to witness against them. For I know that after my death, you will surely act corruptly and turn aside from the way that I've commanded you. In the days to come, evil will befall you, because you will do what is evil in the sight of the Lord, provoking him to anger through the work of your hands. And so, all of this is ultimately designed to be a witness against them for the time that they fail. The song and the law, both of them in particular, and the people are to know this, the song and the law, so they're aware of what the truth of the situation is. All right, any thoughts about chapter 31 before we move on into the Song of Moses, chapter 32? Yeah, no.
This word song, is this like the way we think of it now? Because this is, like, I know we haven't gotten chapter 32, but that's a super long song. Like, is it supposed to be read as poetry or saying?
Yeah, it's definitely poetic in its form. As to the form of singing and how it was done, I can't speak to details on that. I mean, different songs were done differently. It does seem that there were at least kind of some known tunes that they sang to. It seems like there were some that were kind of call and response. It seems that there were some where the priest would sing and the people would sing amen. I mean, I don't know exactly how this one would have gone. I would guess it's to the tune of Amazing Grace, but I mean, that's just a shot in the dark. So, yeah, I almost said something about American Pie and decided not to. So, since you did, I'll blame you for it. I don't know if it's quite that long. All right. Any other comments here? Well, I think I'm contractually obligated to mention that this is a terrible chapter break. Verse 30 really belongs with chapter 32. Moses spoke the words of the song until they were finished in the years of all the assembly of Israel. So that leads into the song itself. Now, as we talk about the Song of Moses, let me start by mentioning a few things kind of by way of introduction, and we may end up spending more time in the introduction than in some of the text itself, but I think this is one of those cases where if you've got a good introduction, the text is a lot clearer to begin with in terms of what's going on. First of all, this has the form of what is sometimes called a covenant lawsuit. This is something you find a whole lot in the prophets. What are called covenant lawsuits. And what this, again, Deuteronomy is in the form of an ancient Near Eastern covenant, which is to say a relationship between a stronger people and a weaker people. And what would happen very frequently is the weaker people would rebel against the stronger people, and they would come in judgment against them. And there would be a lawsuit, covenant lawsuit, against the weaker nation that would be read before they destroyed them. And that's what you find in the prophets. You know, when Isaiah and Micah say, "I call heaven and earth as witness against you," what they are doing is saying, there's a covenant between you and God, and heaven and earth were the witnesses, and now I am calling upon the witnesses to show how you've done these wrong things. And as a result of this, the curses of the covenant that God had talked about in the covenant treaty, Deuteronomy 27 and 28, these are coming to pass as a result. So it's not just prophecy in general, it is covenant prophecy because they've broken the covenant. That's why Deuteronomy is so important to the historical and prophetic books in the Old Testament. Well, Deuteronomy's Song of Moses is a song of judgment for disloyalty. This song matches this kind of pattern of accusing a vassal nation of disloyalty before acting in punishment. But also notice there are two things that surround this song that tell us something about what's going on here beyond just the covenant lawsuit form. That's one of those things. As we look at Deuteronomy, I think we need to know this background. We need to know it's in covenant form. We need to know this is a covenant lawsuit form, so we're aware of what's going on historically and how the people would have heard it. But we also need to not make so much of that that we think that's the primary focus. Deuteronomy has the covenant pattern, but it's primarily three sermons of Moses. And we need to hear them as sermons, not hear them as a covenant document. And likewise, here this is the form of a covenant lawsuit, but it's more than just that. It is instruction first and foremost. Notice in verse 2, "Give ear, O heavens, and I will speak, and let the earth hear the words of my mouth. May my teaching drop as the rain, my speech distill as the dew, like gentle rain upon the tender grass, and like showers upon the earth. It begins with, listen to what I say, listen listen to my teaching, listen to my instruction. And then as it comes to a close in verses 46 and 47, after the song, in fact, is over, when Moses had finished speaking all these words to Israel, he said, "Take to heart all the words by which I'm warning you today, that you may command them to your children, that they may be careful to do all the words of the law, for it is no empty word for you, but it your very life. And by this word you shall live long in the land that you're going over to the Jordan to possess." You know, this isn't just a song to be singing. This is something you're supposed to be learning. And not just learning the words of the tune, but learning what this means. And so fundamentally, this is instruction. It's not just testimony after the fact, but it's a warning beforehand. I mean, the law is a warning beforehand. The song is a warning beforehand. Every time they walk by Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim, they are standing there as warnings beforehand. The pillars that were set up are warnings beforehand. All of this is to teach them what they need to be doing. But then notice also that it's bracketed by praise. That this isn't just teaching, but all of this is to direct them how they're to live their lives ultimately to the glory of God. Verse 3, "I will proclaim the name of the Lord, ascribe greatness to our God." That's where it begins. This is the fundamental teaching he wants them to listen to. This is the message they need to learn, is that God is to be glorified above all else. And as it comes to a conclusion in verse 43, "Rejoice with him, O heavens, bow down to him, all gods, for he avenges the blood of his children and takes vengeance on his adversaries. He repays those who hate him and cleanses his people's land." And so it begins and ends with praise as well, that God's glory is going to outshine all the failures of Israel, and it's ultimately going to be acknowledged by all. That is the message that is being taught here. And then the last thing that I'd say by way of introduction is that this song in itself is just replete with metaphors for God. And it changes from one section to the next, which of these metaphors is being used. I mean, it's somewhat common for metaphors like this to show up in poetry. I don't know offhand any other poetic single, unit of poetry that has this number of metaphors for God all in the same spot. And I don't know that there isn't another one, but it is striking. God is a rock shows up in verses 4, 15, 18, 30, and 31, which speaks of him being stable and dependable and unmovable and safe. God as a father shows up in verses 5 and 6 and 19 and 20, although some of that is more generically parent, really. The same thing with mother, and this is one of those places that, we get all finicky when people use, feminine pronouns to talk about God, and perhaps rightfully so, because he doesn't do that as a rule. But there are feminine images that are used to describe God at times, including the image of a mother. The more generic parent images would fit that as well. But then notice also verse 11, "Like an eagle that stirs up its nest, that flutters over its young, spreading out its wings, catching them, bearing them on its pinions." Again, it doesn't say father eagle or mother eagle, but I think most of us would presume, kind of like Jesus says of the mother hen that would gather her chicks under her wing, that the one protecting the nest would be the mother. But then more precisely, in verse 18, "You were unmindful of the rock that bore you. You forgot the God who gave you birth." That's clearly feminine, motherly imagery, the one who gives birth, which emphasizes, of course, this intimate, close relationship on top of the protective care and parental discipline that the father imagery would bring as well. He's our maker in verse 6, the very reason we exist at all. He is the warrior in verses 41 through 43, his power and his overthrow of all of his adversaries, including his own people. God is the warrior who goes before them into the promised land. He's also the warrior who will come and destroy them when they break the covenant. And then verse 36, he is the judge of the covenant. He is the one who will vindicate. He will punish the wicked and deliver the righteous, which is really the basic description that you would you'd find of, you know, what is this day of the Lord that you find from time to time in the Old Testament? What is the day of the Lord? Well, the day of the Lord is any time that God breaks into time and space and punishes the wicked and delivers the righteous. And there were a variety of days of the Lord. Samaria had a day of the Lord when the Assyrians destroyed them, and Jerusalem had a day of the Lord when the Babylonians destroyed them, and Babylon had a day of the Lord when Cyrus and his armies overthrew them. And ultimately, there will be a final day of the Lord when everything is set right. And all of those are pointing forward to that. And that's the warrior-judge imagery as well. So all of that kind of by way of backdrop then, quickly to work our way through the song itself in the time that we have remaining, verses 1 through 6, 1b through 6, you might say, is the case being stated, the witnesses being called. Give ear, O heavens, and I will speak, and let the earth hear the words of my mouth. May my teaching drop as the rain, my speech distill as the dew, like gentle rain upon the tender grass, like showers upon the herb. For I will proclaim the name of the Lord. Ascribe greatness to our God. The rock, his work is perfect, for all his ways are justice. A God of faithfulness and without iniquity, just and upright is he. They have dealt corruptly with him. They are no longer his children because they are blemished. They are a crooked and twisted generation. Do you thus repay the Lord, you foolish and senseless people? Is not he your father who created you, who made you and established you of old? So heaven and earth are called as witnesses again, as they were in chapter 4 and chapter 30 and chapter 31, as they are in Isaiah chapter 1 and Micah chapter 6 as well. By contrast, God is perfect and just and faithless and sinless and upright, and the people have dealt corruptly in this relationship. And so the beginning of the case is laid out here. And from here we get to the actual case itself in verses 7 through 14, something of a historical review. Here is just how you've broken the covenant. Remember the days of old. Consider the years of many generations. Ask your father and he will show you, your elders, and they will tell you. When the Most High gave to the nations their inheritance, when he divided mankind, he fixed the borders of the peoples according to the number of the sons of God. Behold, the Lord's portion is his people, Jacob his allotted heritage. He found him in a desert land, and in the howling waste of the wilderness. He encircled him, he cared for him, he kept him as the apple of his eye, like an eagle that stirs up its nest, that flutters over its young, spreading out its wings, catching them, bearing them on its pinions. The Lord alone guided him. No foreign god was with him. He made him ride in the high places of the land, and he ate the produce of the field, and he suckled him with honey out of the rock and oil out of the flinty rock, curds from the herd and milk from the flock, with fat of lambs, rams of Bashan and goats, with the very finest of the wheat, and you drank foaming wine made from the blood of the grape. And so, remember the story. Remember how things were. You remember what God did. God has guided your history, and God alone has guided your history. You caught that as we read that verse 12. The Lord alone guided them. No foreign god was with him. Well, if God alone guided you and no other god helped you, what does that tell you about who your loyalty is to be to? Instead, however, verses 15 through 18, but Jeshurun grew fat and kicked. You grew fat, stout, and sleek. He forsook God who made him and scoffed at the rock of his salvation. They stirred him to jealousy with strange gods, with abominations. They provoked him to anger. They sacrificed to demons that were no gods, to gods that they had never known, to new gods that had come recently, whom your fathers had never dreaded. You were unmindful of the rock that bore you, and you forgot the God who gave you birth. And so, again, the fundamental sin that Deuteronomy has been at pains to warn against more than anything else is idolatry, and that's what they do. They go straight into that. Let me mention in passing, verse 15, Jeshurun is apparently an alternate poetic title for Israel. It shows up in the next chapter, in verses 5 and 26 of chapter 33. Where it's clearly referring to Israel. It shows up in Isaiah 44, where it's clearly referring to Israel. It seems to mean something along the lines of the upright one, which they're not here. So it may be being used ironically in this context, but it's not always used ironically. Everywhere else it does seem to carry more of that sort of meaning. Beyond that, we really don't know a whole lot about it. It just shows up four times in the Bible, kind of out of the blue. But it is almost certainly, and beyond almost certainly, a reference to Israel in this context. But again, the larger point here is they've fallen into this fundamental sin of idolatry. And so the sentence then is pronounced in verses 19 through 25. The Lord saw it and spurned them because of the provocation of his sons and his daughters. He said, I will hide my face from them. I will see what their end will be, for they are a perverse generation, children in whom is no faithfulness. They have made me jealous with what is no God. They've provoked me to anger with their idols, so I will make them jealous with those who are no people. I will provoke them to anger with a foolish nation. For a fire is kindled by my anger, and it burns to the depths of Sheol, devours the earth and its increase, and sets on fire the foundations of the mountains. And I will heap disasters upon them. I will spend my arrows on them. They shall be wasted with hunger and devoured by plague and poisonous pestilence. I will send the teeth of beasts against them with the venom of things that crawl in the dust. Outdoors the sword shall bereave, and indoors terror. For young man and woman alike, the nursing child with a man of gray hairs. It's not a good situation, obviously. You've got the anger of God. I think you've got the pain of God as well. The God who sees is the God who hides his face. And part of that is hiding his face from them so that they can no longer see him and he will no longer see them. But I can't help but think of hiding one's face and sorrow is perhaps a piece of this as well. There is a very poetic justice here. They've made me jealous with what is no God, so I'll make them jealous with those who are not a people. They've provoked me to anger with their idols. I'll provoke them to anger with a foolish nation. I'll take a bunch of nobodies and wipe them out. And he doesn't mean nobodies politically. I mean, Babylon clearly wasn't that. But from the only perspective that matters, you've got Israel and you've got this pagan nation. Which one matters? It's the people of God. And God is taking this nobody nation that are not his people and destroying his own people with them and with their gods leading the way that are no gods at all. And so it's very poetic justice, but it's also a covenant justice as well. You can't help but hear echoes of Deuteronomy 28 and the covenant curses in some of what is said here. So it's not just he's angry, it's the covenant is broken. And so the curses of the covenant are coming upon you now because of this. And so the judge will stop now at this point and deliberate a little bit further. He says, I would have said, I'll cut them to pieces and I'll wipe them from human memory had I not feared provocation by the enemy, lest their adversaries should misunderstand, lest they should say, our hand is triumphant. It was not the Lord who did all of this. For they are a nation void of counsel, and there is no understanding among them. If they were wise, they would understand this. They would discern their latter end. How could one have chased 1,000 and two have put 10,000 to the fight unless their rock had sold them and the Lord had given them up? For their rock is not as our rock, for our enemies are by themselves. For their vine comes from the vine of Sodom and from the fields of Gomorrah. Their grapes are grapes of poison. Their clusters are bitter. Their wine is the poison of serpents and the cruel venom of asps. Is not this laid up in store with me, sealed up in my treasuries? And so God kind of stops for a minute and says, well, if I completely destroy them, I would destroy them, but if I completely destroy them, people aren't going to understand. People aren't going to realize it's because I've rejected them. They're just going to think that this God is worthless and our God is stronger. If they had any sense about this, they'd realize what their end is going to be as well. But they're not going to see that. They're not going to realize that their rock had sold them, that their Lord had given up on them. They're fighting out there by themselves because their gods aren't even gods, but no one's going to understand this. And so something is going to have to be different from completely wiping them out. And you find the answer then, vengeance is mine in recompense for the time when their foot shall slip. For the day of their calamity is at hand, and their doom comes swiftly. For the Lord will vindicate his people and have compassion on his servants when he sees their power is gone, and there is none remaining, bond or free. Then he will say, Where are their gods, the rock in whom they took refuge, who ate the fat of their sacrifices and drank the wine of their drink offering? Let them rise up and help you. Let them be your protection. See now that I, even I, am he, and there is no God beside me. I kill and I make alive, I wound and I heal, and there is none other that can deliver out of my hand. For I lift up my hand to heaven and swear, as I live forever, if I sharpen my flashing sword and my hand takes hold on judgment, I will take vengeance on my adversary and repay those who hate me. I will make my arrows drunk with blood, and my sword shall devour flesh with the blood of the slain and the captive from the long-haired heads of the enemy. Well, we don't have time to really talk about this much more. We read the concluding praise already. Let me just say briefly about this end, that God is going to act in judgment, but those who God uses for judgment, they will fall as well. That is the clear picture that is being painted here. The very gods that Israel had looked to for help, they find that there's no shelter there, there's no strength there. They're weak and they're defenseless. And that is always the case with idolatry. False gods never fail to fail. That's what they do. And unfortunately, we never fail to forget. And so we just keep turning to them, generation in and generation out. And so the concluding exhortation to all of this in verses 44 through 47 is that life is found in doing the words of the law. I'll read these last few verses and then we'll stop for today and pick up in verse 48 and wrap up the book next week. Moses came and recited all the words of this song in the hearing of all the people, he and Joshua, the son of Nun. And when Moses had finished speaking all these words to all Israel, he said to them, "Take to heart all the words by which I am warning you today, that you may command them to your children, that they may be careful to do all the words of this law. For it is no empty word for you, but your very life. And by this word you shall live long in the land that you are going over the Jordan to possess." All right, next week we'll wrap up the book of Deuteronomy.